Can we go to questions? Or shall I give you a few moments to assemble your serious thoughts or non-serious thoughts or light-hearted questions? You know my glance is going to fall on some of you, don't you? Because I promised that. Right. Shall we let her have her question? Yeah.
Can I just ask what cat is?
K-H-A-T.
K-H-A-T.
You were thinking little furry sweet things, weren't you? Oh, love. And why are they chewing them, you were thinking? Oh, my God, aren't artists terrible, you were thinking?
It's a leaf, and the stimulating feeling is similar to coffee.
Ah, OK.
It's quite often used by people who culturally don't drink. Sort of gather together in a cafe and watch football, and she's a leaf and chat. Because it's social images.
Thank you.
I've got some place cards here where you can access the script through a QR code. And you can have this because you asked about it, so you can have it. But basically, the script is in there and it talks about what cat is as well. So,
Claire, I've got two questions. One, can you just explain effective labour again, please?
Okay.
Who's so really glad I asked that question? Okay. Because everyone else knew what it was. That's it.
Okay. So effective labour is a particular type of labour that we do. Say if you're serving and you have to smile at customers, it's not written in your job description, but it's something that you might need to do as part of your job, it's being good as your job, at your job, that we would call effective labour.
Being nice to students?
Being nice to students. Going to openings might be a source of immaterial labour where you use effective labour, good networking, smiling.
That we're smiling.
I hope someone got that moment.
So that's in the simplest way. So often it's cited that a flight attendant uses effective labour because they've got to be nice to all the passengers.
Is it conscious or unconscious, or is it both? Does it become so fully internalised that people do it all the time?
I think it's fully internalised, and then I think of when I go to a restaurant and somebody, you know, doesn't treat me particularly well with their effective labour, I start to enjoy that. And I think, compared to America, we're quite good at undermining the demand for effective labour. I see that happen sometimes. Say I'm at a restaurant and I'm getting a kind of surly response from the waitress. I smile to myself because they're not quite. There's a refusal there, I suppose.
They're not just being robots.
Do you see it as a resistance?
Yes. Yeah. You think they're being robots?
No, but not being robots, a robot would smile and just be like, thank you,
okay.
Like a mid-day automated response, like,
yeah,
so where you actually have somebody who's in a bad mood, it's, like, it can break that a bit, and it's nice because the system's not working perfectly and all,
exactly.
You know, clockworky.
Yeah, and and then there's a consciousness of effective labour. It's not just going through the emotions of it, I suppose, yeah.
Wait till the mic gets so we can't think of it.
I sort of feel like actually the point to me holding this and just holding something, so you have to wait.
Yeah, Ella, could you smile while you hand it? Thank you. Now, her holding that would have been really effective, though, wouldn't it?
Yes, you have to hold.
Yeah, okay, it's just not holding. Yeah. Do you think
maybe they're in a good mood, because they have to be, but they are actually in a good mood.
That went straight across my brain. Can you say it again, sorry?
So maybe because they have to have this kind of front, it makes them actually in a good mood.
Oh. So that's a bit like CBT.
Yes.
It's almost exactly like CBT. In one session, though.
Yes, yeah.
In a constant session, yeah.
Maybe at that moment they might be mimicking something, but I don't think that means somebody then goes home and the smile continues. No. Do you?
Yeah, maybe.
Can I abuse the fact that I have the mic?
Yeah.
And it's not a question, it's an additional observation. One of the most fantastic meals I've ever had was not due to, well, the food was very good. We were in a restaurant in Lisbon and this crowd of really rich Americans came in, and the more demanding they were, the more surly and absolutely contemptuous the overworked waitress became. And we enjoyed that spectacle of them demanding more and more and getting less and less. And to the extent where we were then worried that she might have her job taken away. But she was fantastic.
And holding position.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. So that's, I think, what I feel when somebody's resisting the effective labour moment, I suppose. But maybe other people don't. Maybe so in a way, then I'm feeling a CBT moment as you're feeling the you're being affected by that resistance, and that gives us hope. And that makes us happy. So there is hope.
There's a question here, and while Mike goes there to add to the restaurant stories, in Poon's, which is a very old Chinese restaurant in London, where they're noted for their surliness, I remember the waitress once saying to me, "You don't come here for good service, you come here for cheap food."
What was your response?
Because I like good service. Question.
Thanks. Can two link together? First one is, why did you want people to call out names, and how did it affect you when you were giving your talk?
Okay, so all the names that you've had, that some might have been called out, are from people who have I don't like to say before, but they've been involved in the work one way or another. And there may be people here who are also been involved in the work. So I've asked some people to come in. I've paid for some people to come in here and be part of this. So in my own self-sabotage of my fee, and I felt the interruption. What I thought would happen is those names would resonate with me, but instead of resonating with me, I was trying to not hear them so that I could continue speaking. I found it quite hard to hold my train of thoughts while names were being called out. So it did something different. It really did feel like an interruption. And I thought through a process of crediting, I would go back and forth in time in my head and remember where those people were in the work. But it really did feel like an interruption. I didn't expect so many names to be called out. And what I wanted, in a way, is to, for everyone to have that sense of shall I, shan't I, when, and sort of be implicated in a process of interruption. So even if people didn't call the name out, they had this sort of sense of slight distraction or anxiety about holding somebody else's name and whether to participate or not. And a sort of act of non-participation, very much a participation now.
And there was one person who was like that, don't know about
this. I thought it was extraordinary when it started because, you know, this is a very quiet group of students. You know, questions have to be squeezed out of them to talk. You know, you can't even get them to hold the microphone. Oh, God, no, I'm not going to do it. And then it started, and they went into absolute flurries. And I was thinking, is this the paid audience who's doing that, or are these the students, you know, I know and love? You know who I'm thinking about, because you're not looking at me, something. Who have a resistance to questioning. So what happened in the room? And maybe that's for people to answer here. What happened in the room when it started? Alex, are you going to answer that question?
I'm not.
Oh, for God's sake, answer the question.
I was really curious about what you think the relationship between sort of disruption and activation is. And I think I'm kind of thinking about this in particular in relation to sort of group shows that you've been involved in where this sort of the disruptive nature of the work perhaps activates other works in its sort of periphery, or not?
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, the one piece that, well, one of the pieces I didn't show you was one where a friend who died got onto a long list for a show, didn't make the short list. I made the short list. So I decided to show his work and have it put up and taken down as part of the opening. So it wasn't included, but and there was a sniffer dog who sniffed it out and got it taken down and got it put up as a whole. And meanwhile, I ran a cloakroom. So that relationship between inserting somebody else's work in there, but sort of, I don't want to say collaborating with the dead, but it did feel a bit like bringing somebody who, because he died, his work, although I'd organised a for his work to be shown at the Lowry, ever since that it just remained in an uncle's attic. So there was a moment of reenacting, kind of bringing that to life in some way, or using my power in some other way. The cloakroom was just a front to organise a sniffer dog and the and having the work in and out. So there was a sort of disruption and activation in that piece, I would say, that his name wasn't included on all the information, but I'd inserted a piece about his work as a loose sheet. I think sometimes it activates others' work. So sometimes I'm a citation in their work, and sometimes their citation in mine. So there is that, you know, there's a complicity in that, and a sort of sometimes that's uncomfortable. And I think those sort of things need to get exposed a bit, and how you expose them. For me, it's through scripts, really, post-event scripts, where I show all the tricks, if you like, that you don't always get in the performance. So you get new information in the scripts about those sort of relations that have gone on. Does that answer it?
It does. So it's kind of like the magician explaining how the trick works when the explanation is perhaps even more interesting than the deceit sort of thing.
Yeah, and in a way that after the event, it doesn't always pan out as I might think it would, so then I can include other things in it that I'm not in control of. They get reimagined, I suppose, in a way too. So it's a funny sort of dissemination where it becomes more valuable than going to the actual thing somehow in terms of exposing kind of the trick, the confidence trick. And I suppose economics is all like that anyway, it's all a confidence trick in a way. So if I'm talking about money in a script, you see how the structure might operate, or planting Semtex on a dog so that he can sniff out the right work or people, where at the actual event people are wondering, how does a dog know to pick that piece of work? You know, but it's sort of exposed. And then, yeah, I think it becomes more critical somehow, yeah.
I wanted to ask about delivery. So in the questions, I'm noticing that you're very animated and lots of eye contact and gestures. And then you chose to deliver a script which constrained you and bound you and I can't remember the word you used. Back delivery, was it?
Deadpan.
Deadpan delivery, yeah. And it reminded me of your PhD, the situation of being bound across your chest. And I wanted to could you talk a bit more about that?
I think because I have a difficult relationship with documentation or the reproducing of an artist's myth, which is what artist talks really are, and often promotion comes into it, you know, more people know what you do. I think I'm a bit resistant in effective labour in that sense, so I'm aware that it's deadpan, and there's a slight performative quality in there. I'm sort of not going, I come with quite a lot of stuff and half of it doesn't get talked about. So there's a sense of editing in it, or a refusal to entertain, I suppose, a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's a bit. Also, I think I do have a slight fear of presenting, so it's a prop, isn't it? It's a thing that you can hold on to. But I'm aware then, poise goes, we don't do this and this and feel comfortable, which is what happened in the PhD when I was constricted physically. It exacerbates a kind of fear of presenting in a way. So, I suppose it is a choice. And I'm playing with the artist's talk form a bit. Subtly. It's very subtle. but, you know, even in the interruptions or the sense of I'm here, paid to do a talk. What I'm talking about is being performed in a way that is it sort of slips between work and presentation, I think, for me, doing these things.
Where's the power relation in the room for you?
I think that shifts around a bit because, you know, people can leave, they can walk out, they can choose not to shout out names, mm-hmm. although I've controlled that a little bit with mm-hmm. inviting some people here mm-hmm. to do that, to get that going. But at the same time, it's quite... It, you know, it's an authority position to give a talk at the same time. You're here with the authority of your work. So it slips around for me. So when people walk out, you start to feel a bit uncomfortable. But in the same time, you have the authority of voice. Is that what you meant?
Mm. Debbie?
I was just wondering what you had to do with her names.
That's a good point.
Oh, that's so a nervous question. What, yeah. What's your name? Yes, what's your name?
I thought because you've all contributed, and some of you even in your heads, next time I write names, if I re-perform this exercise, if you like, or this piece of work where anybody who's been involved in the work goes on a slip of paper, I thought I'd include all yours in it. Because I think it's an ongoing piece of work that will get done again somewhere. That's why I said if you don't want to use your real name, don't. Somebody's put Queen Bitch here. But that is
her real name.
reggae sauce, pooch. You know, we've got, you know, some people have played with that. So, yeah.
I can just project my voice.
Right, go on.
How did you get into employing people as a practice?
I think it was that first video I showed. Well, I showed the shooting video right at the beginning.
With the police officers.
Yeah, because I made that work and I didn't really think about delegated performance. It was 97. The term had been 1997.
When in 97?
June, probably. I can't remember. But yeah, why?
Okay. I existed as an egg.
It was the summer. No, that much.
Yeah, I was probably a fermented, fertilised egg by then.
I take no timeline. a long time ago. So,
how did that occur to you, though?
I went to Lewisham Market, I think, at the time, and bought lots of those toys, and I didn't really know what I was going to do with them. I just enjoy getting them through customs and questions, and there was a patrol car that used to patrol around. It's hard to remember the thought processes, but I suppose I thought, I was interested in the screen of the video. We were doing some videoing, and I was interested in the flies that came in and out, or something like that. I can't really remember. So something triggered these things being taken off the screen. I thought they would be blown out of the screen, not just kind of... So things that were going on in my head didn't actually happen.
It
was relational.
It reminded me of the Monty Python sketch where people are hiding in bushes and they slowly blow them up.
Yes.
I'm not sure if you know it.
Yes. I love Monty Python. So, yeah,
how many reference. People watched it when they came in? You did, clearly. The video at the beginning that you came on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I wasn't sure if it was a background that wasn't seen, or whether...
It sparked conversations or differences.
Okay. Question here, and probably last question, and then I think Claire needs a drink.
And then you can talk to her.
And then you can talk to her. You can come up in a quiet, weird way to her.
Can I just ask you to say something about the residue of the pieces? Because so much of the conversation has been about the performance and the reconstruction and the thought process and the script. And I was thinking very much about the piece I recently saw, the most recent piece I recently saw, and also in the Whitworth, the carpet piece there. And I remember spending a long time trying to deconstruct the thought process into the way that that final object or stage had been left, and why the certain areas have been picked in the carpet and certain areas that not, and there seem to be both decisions and non-decisions, and then a stage left with a rather oblique set of clues.
Okay. So that was really, I mean, in a way, I think I'm, you know, that's created by Elizabeth Price, that work. And she wanted to rethink the carpet piece that I've done. I've done carpet picking, employ people to unpick and instruct people to unpick carpet for quite a long time, probably since about 2006. So to me, that's a long time. So Elizabeth, I've finished with carpet picking. I'm sick of that piece. I didn't. So it's really somebody else bringing it back to life, somebody else putting it on Vito Acconci's seabed piece, which is a piece from the 1970s, I think. And Vito Acconci is wanking underneath the stage as people come in, and this piece is put on top of it. So in terms of us not being a sort of singular artist, that's Elizabeth Price bringing that in back and using it as a citation and utilising it as citing some other work. So that's how... I do remember with the carpet pieces, a supervisor at the time when I was on PhD said, stop doing these carpet pieces, and I thought, no, I'm not finished with them yet. You know, there is things play out, and I would say Merle Ladderman Ukeli's, her work goes over long periods of time, and in a way they're less touristy then in terms of social practice, where you just come in, do something, move on. So when things get redone, rethought, they have this longevity to them. So when people in the work appear again and again and again, sort of the storing of it somehow changes from this sense of production that is just... Sorry, that's my phone, which is terrible. I didn't listen.
It's your phone?
Yes.
Yeah, but it's that as well.
I'll
pass it and I'll answer it because it's for me.
Yeah, you could talk to my daughter about her mocks and how they've gone. I think really what work does is, you know, we all know it's not linear, but things go on the back burner, they come back and forth. So the video piece right at the beginning, I have shown now twice, and the last time before that it was shown was probably 1990-something. You know, it had a very short life. And it just seems to resonate with certain conditions of now, so I brought it back. I don't know if I'm answering the question.
No, that's a nice way to end.
Okay.
We will end, and I'd like to go back to your remark on resistance and hope, because in these dark times, it's a good place to end. Thank you very much, Claire, for a fantastic talk. Thank you all.